previously on Popping Collars.
Fascinating to see that it's basically, you're basically signing up for a life of death, but it's kind of right there in the title of the show, right?
Give that.
It's not called The Sons of Pugs and Puppies. Yeah,
right. No, it's not. That's a whole other game.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture, the show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida, and I'm your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests, who this week include Betsy Gonzalez from Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Betsy.
Hello, Greg.
Kyle Goodman from Statesville, North Carolina. Welcome back, Kyle.
Glad to be here.
And a very special guest this week, Mike Friedrich from Berkeley, California. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hello, glad to be here.
This is episode 22 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is comic book mythology. So one person that's on this show actually has a Wikipedia page, and that's Mike. So that's exciting.
Did someone take down my Wikipedia page? Come on.
Did you have one, Betsy?
No, but Mike has one. Mike has one.
Well, just a quick thumbnail of Mike's involvement in the world of superhero comics. He was a writer on DC's Justice League in the early 70s, before moving to Marvel and writing Iron Man through 1975. So he's had a foot in both of the big two comic producers. And with the San Diego Comic-Con wrapping up fairly recently, we thought this would be a good opportunity to bring Mike on and talk a little bit about the role mythology plays in writing comics, kind of, but really in maintaining the stories. Both Superman and Batman just celebrated their 75th anniversaries and are set to star in a mega blockbuster movie next year. Captain America is still going strong in the Avengers franchise. He traces his history back to the Second World War. So what is it about these stories that make them compelling even now? And what keeps them going? How in the world is a World War II war hero who famously punched Adolf Hitler on the cover of his magazine, how is he still relevant in the 21st century?
I think part of the reason that they're relevant is that other than reading ancient mythology or involving ourselves in a world of biblical mythology that the majority of the church would be uncomfortable with even calling mythology, that's something that we lack in American culture. There are so many other, societies with a much older history, and in those societies, there's myths that have existed for a long time. I'm thinking about the Norse mythology of Scandinavia, or the Greek and Roman mythology that we're all so familiar with. But there really has never been much of an American mythology. Maybe the Wild West.
Paul Bunyan,
right.
Yeah, George Washington, always, cherry tree.
The only observation I have about this, and since we're still in the middle of it, it's a tentative one, is that I think we're trying as a society to cope with the fact that we're this global empire that maintains its power through military force. And so we have to tell ourselves stories about how we're punching people in the face because we're the good guys. And so all the threats of the superhero movies especially are all galactic and global and gigantic. Entire cities are going to die if we don't punch somebody in the face. the world is going to collapse if we don't punch somebody in the face. So we have to be out there ready to punch somebody in the face. Now, maybe in 50 years somebody will debunk this theory, but that's the one I've got.
Well, I think it's also that element of free will, right? We gotta, we gotta be able to pursue ourselves, so that you have those bad guys who are out there who want to turn everybody into mindless automatons, or they're gonna control you and feed off of your culture in a way that then you don't have free choice anymore. So that value of that American ideal of being able to pursue your life freely without crime or threat and be able to be all you can be. See, I easily drift into cliche, you know, when you start talking about this. But yeah.
And not just cliche, the tagline of our military.
It's true. I was tag teaming off Mike's military comment there. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not a bad idea, because it that kind of gets at the reason that a character like Captain America still resonates, right? Because you're talking about a century of war, basically, that Americans have lived through over the 20th century, right? And this soldier can basically be, with a mask, right, can become the soldier of any era, right? He's just the soldier's story. So it doesn't mean that he's a World War II veteran. It means that he's a Korean veteran. He's a Vietnam veteran. He's a Gulf War veteran. Like, he's all of these things. And that's why his story can keep going, is because we keep going to war. We keep fighting people.
And there's kernels in the other stories, too. I mean, you know, Batman, bad stuff happens to good people. And what are you going to do with it? You know, another universal of living in life and struggle. And so kind of, and it even happens to the most privileged of people. And so, well, here's how that turns and twists inside an individual, and then how that turn and twist plays out on society.
And even Superman, you know, who is, you know, the strongest of all the heroes, and it seems like, you know, we could never identify with Superman. Well, Superman is the consummate outsider who's always just trying to figure out how to fit in this world. And even in that, I think we can identify and relate to the character.
Well, Superman, which started out as a very simple character in the late 1930s, and then added a ton of layers in the 50s, having to do with this whole backstory that got augmented. They created Krypton pretty early, but did all the layering in the mid-50s. And as Gerard Jones and others have pointed out, it was really a reflection on the Holocaust, this lost world that will never get back, and being in a strange land now, and all this very deep stuff that was just done as a superhero story or series of stories, and yet everyone took to it. The audience was ready for it, and now you couldn't do a Superman story without it. I mean, every movie has Krypton and Jor-El and, you know, all of those, the characters from the Negative Zone and everything else. All of which were actually 50s creations instead of 30s creations.
Like, there needed to be this journey motif layered in as well. You know, I saw it in the Supergirl reboot on their long trailer they released or whatever. There's Krypton. There it is again. You know, linking
right,
back.
The hero has to be a hero for a reason. It can't just be like a guy in like a strongman costume. There's this idea that, well, he's got to come from somewhere. Like, he can't just appear. He's got to be a hero for a reason.
Well, the fascinating part about this is, looking at it as a canon, is that it's informed the way I've come to look at our Christian canon as something that was developed over time, developed based on what the, if you want to call it, the audience wanted to hear. And it helps us understand the audience as well as the writers, that they're in a dialogue with each other over decades, in the same way that our comic book superheroes have evolved over the same number of, actually more decades now, but that at some point the canon closed. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be very difficult now to do additional backstory for the origin of Superman. I mean, you could do it, but it would be considered secondary.
And I think that answers in part what Greg was asking earlier about why are we still interested in stories about these characters that should have died out 50 years ago? I mean, overall, having a closed canon, so to speak, and, you know, everyone who's buying into that canon or has for for 30 years is if the canon of superheroes is closed, then we're, in that same space of limiting what can be new. And really, all the stories are just repeating at this point, right? It's the same villains over and over again, the same, kinds of situations that the heroes find themselves in. I mean, even the movies are all derivative stories of earlier comic creations.
Yeah, I've been puzzled by that and have a hard time explaining it. I mean, why they reboot Spider-Man and do the same story over again. They're on their third iteration of it in the movies now, and of course, Superman, they've rebooted a couple of times. I still don't quite understand, and it's probably just my role of having been involved in it so long, how superheroes stopped being a niche cultural interest and became this huge, massive representation of American society. Mm-hmm. And I'm puzzled by that.
Anytime you get a double-sized issue of Spider-Man, anything, right? There's always like a three-page sort of creator cartoon that retells you sort of the Spider-Man origin. Like, I don't know how many Death of Ben Parker stories I've read in my life, but I think it's a lot. I think I've read about 100 Death of Ben Parker stories. And it makes me wonder, like, why do we have to keep retelling ourselves the story over and over again? Is it so that the character of Spider-Man is ingrained in us? Or is there some kind of power in the retelling of the story? Is there some kind of power in knowing that Thomas and Martha Wayne are going to get shot on Crime Alley every single time?
Well, that's funny because, of course, where all that emerged was from a very commercial need to keep your characters fresh in the eyes of new readers because there was turnover, particularly in the early days, when turnover was very high, kids would read comics for 2 or 3 years, and that was it. And so if you didn't retell the story of Thomas and Martha Wayne, people would be befuddled as to who is this guy? Why is he running around in this weird outfit?
He's so dark. So dark.
He's so brooding and earnest.
Well, and it gets into the kinds of questions that every congregation has to answer about: do we keep the kids in service or not, or do we send them off to Sunday school? It's like, well, if we send them off, are they hearing the same stories we're hearing, or are they hearing, what are they hearing when they're out of the room? And so we've got the same kinds of discussions going on in our church culture as well.
Round and around the lectionary we go every 3 years, and that opportunity to come back and be different. And I'm sure, that happens in comic books too. Do you read that story of Peter Parker differently as a boy in your room who loves science and it's so cool. And then you read it differently when you're in college and differently when you become a parent and differently, you come back to it at different times because you're different. Now, the story is the same, but you're different.
And I think that Kyle hit something on the head, too, when he was talking about the need for an American mythology. And we are in this kind of post-Christian environment, and yet we still have these religious themes running through everything. I was fascinated to learn that a few years ago that the original name for Superman, Kal-El, is Hebrew for voice of God. Mm-hmm. And it was just a little thing that the Jewish authors put in there to sort of authenticate the character. Not that they ever talked about it that way or portrayed the character that way in any overt sense, but there it was.
Betsy and I just had a great conversation with a former professor of ours, Richard Lindsay, about the role that camp and kitsch play in popular culture. And when we were talking about Batman, Betsy, and this idea of, this brooding guy, that got me thinking about the layers that we put on characters, because, the Batman that a lot of people grew up was not an earnest, brooding character.
Darkness, no parents, right.
He was the campiest, probably, character superhero ever when that TV show came out in the 60s. And it makes me wonder, like, you know, this actually may be a great question for you, Mike, because, you know, someone writing in the 70s JLA stories, like, that had to have affected that character in the DC, in the minds of writers at DC, in a way that, you know, was there this sense that, you know, did he need to be reclaimed? Is this who he is now? He is Adam West from now on. Like, there had to be, like, this whole level of, what do we do with this character now, right?
Well, I think, I certainly at the time, I was part of the group of people that felt that the Camp Batman would have gone off the rails. And, yes, reclaimed is a good word, that there is sort of essential canonical idea of the of this character at the edge of night and darkness. Personally, I always thought of him as the guy that traveled all the way to the edge of being evil but never crossed the line. Now, others of my creative colleagues crossed the line, but I always felt that was what made Batman different from the other characters, was that he went over to the dark side and looked in, but didn't go there. And that, you couldn't do that in the camp concept of the character. It was part of the creature of the night character. And so when I did my Batman stories, and I just did a handful of them, they were very much precursors of what came later with, especially Frank Miller. But even Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams kind of did the first reclaiming around 1970, 71, I forget the exact year, that kind of started that path back to where the character now is clearly, you know, 180 degrees away from the 60s camp concept.
Well, it's like the 1950s Jesus, right? He got a little too doe-eyed, a little too feminine, a little too fluffy Jesus. We got to buff up Jesus. We got to, you know, in the same way we buffed up all our church architecture, you know, more poured concrete, rising obelisk, you know, no illusions in that, right? But, you know, it's like, yeah, it's like that 70s time of kind of what is, you know, femininity is coming in and feminism, but what's the masculine thing? What's happening? It's interesting.
Yeah, Denny O'Neill, in interviews, he'll always say that, you know, speaking of mythology, he always claims superhero comics as being American post-industrial mythology. Like, that's how he understands these stories. And that implies, like, a level of grittiness, of dirtiness, of darkness, I think. Because I think that's kind of what whenever I think of industrialism, I think of my time in Pittsburgh and just how stained everything was, you know, with the steel in the city and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I think that kind of colored his ideas. But then again, you're talking about a generation of people who had actually finally grown up with the characters, who were now able to write the characters, which had to have some kind of influence over what you guys were doing.
Yeah, well, of course it did, but it's hard for us to talk about it. You're the ones that have to talk about it. I mean, from the inside, it was just, oh boy, the character should do this, the character should do that, and there was this sense of who the character was, but I couldn't articulate it at the time. I was very young. I was 18, 19, 20. I stopped writing comics when I was 25. Mm. And today you can't even start writing until you've done a television show. Mm. So it's a completely different environment.
I'm kind of curious about, so you brought up Frank Miller earlier, Mike, and I think that a lot of people point towards that mid 80s time as really kind of a turning point for how comics were not just viewed, but how they were kind of done. I think everything kind of changed with really Alan Moore with Watchmen, and then you had Frank Miller, who kind of started taking Daredevil down a different path and then kind of fully realized it with The Dark Knight Returns and Batman. And these were really more kind of deconstructions of all of the mythology, right? So Frank Miller is stripping Batman down to the very essential parts that are left and saying, what is it? Like, who is a man that hopes for a good death, right? Like he does at the beginning of that book. Like, who is this? And certainly Alan Moore is doing kind of a similar thing with Watchmen. It was definitely this turn of, okay, we've been writing these silly characters about these stories, but wait a second, who are these characters? And why do they have so much meaning to us? And that's what that's where I think comics still live today.
Well, it's kind of, in my view, it's very similar to architecture over a long period of time. You go through these additions and additions, and it gets more and more broke, and then somebody cleans it all away and gets rid of all the artifice and goes back to basic, you know, sticks. But then those get to be boring after a while, and so the next generation starts coloring the sticks and adding other sticks to them. And I think that in the 80s, the comics made that shift into fully treating their readership as at least a young adult readership and no longer a children's readership. And I think that was a good part of why that deconstruction occurred in the 80s, and why everything since then, though, has probably been slowly adding it back on. There's this natural rhythm to it, and there's no reason why comics mythology wouldn't follow the other public art forms that we have that are cultural art forms.
I think that's a really interesting point, and I am a current comics reader. Seeing how, you know, there is this ebb and flow. I'm thinking about the excesses of the 90s comic books, you know, with the big guns and the big arms and the large-breasted women and, you know, all of these exaggerated panels. And in some sense, it was sort of an art-heavy and art-focused time in comics. And we wandered far afield in that regard, and then really, in the last 15 years, I think things have become much more, you know, story focused and much more, you know, plot driven. And I think it, again, is a reaction to that ebb and flow of what's important and what matters in comics.
So I'm struck how that contrasts with society. That, like, 80s culture was all about artifice and art and that, but what's really making it tick underneath, like, mm-hmm. where, you know, there's so much surface. And then 90s, you think flannel and stripping it down, but no, we're going to go over the top on art, and there's the reactionary element too.
Well, the question that I have is, how does this help us inform our Christian studies? I mean, this idea, if we learn from society that we go through these ebbs and flows and layering and layering and layering and then deconstructing and then layering and layering and layering and then deconstructing. Where does that take us when we look at our biblical studies?
Some people would like bristle to hear you talk about the Bible in any sort of mythological, because that means unicorns and Pegasuses and, you know, whatever, you know, no, that's not what we're talking about. That inside every mythology, there's truth at its mm-hmm. kernel. And there's something that people are looking for and striving for. So kind of what is the truth that's being communicated in this extra fantastic long lives or fantastic strengths or what is this really saying about what humanity values, what they love, and who they think the creator is? And so that kind of allowing them to move past mythology being a dirty word, being a word that means fake, to being, well, actually, it actually means something much, much different and much, much deeper. So don't dismiss it, embrace it, and dig deeper.
No, I totally agree. I think, you know, mythology, you know, is a way of us using a common language to get at truth.
It strikes me interesting that even the book of Genesis itself is a combination of different mythologies or at least different worldviews. You know, all of the historical critical folks talk about, you know, the different authors that are really speaking through Genesis and the rest of the Pentateuch, and the ways that those different voices, whether it's the J voice or the E voice or the D voice, you know, kind of bringing their own different perspective. And so you get, just as a for instance, in the first two chapters of the book of Genesis, two different creation stories told, you know, for different reasons and different voices. And yet, you know, somehow they seem to be blended together, not seamlessly, but blended together in one book to tell, you know, the creation story of the Hebrew people. And which in fact is two stories that don't exactly perfectly line up, but both have value, and both have value beside each other, complementing each other, perhaps.
Yeah, they got a little better in the Noah story, right? On taking two and putting them together, because they go into the ark, and then they go into the ark again, and then it's
right.
Is it two animals or seven pairs of two? Like,
seven.
Like, yeah. You know, really, you know, as opposed to, all right, we'll lay them side by side, go with what you want, and in our constructive brain, we put them together, and they're one story, and Adam and Eve are on the sixth day or whatever. But and then I think at the same time, we did like what Mike was talking about. You strip it down, right? Like, thinking about the red letter Bibles. What did Jesus actually say? Let's cast votes to figure out what we think is the real Jesus. And then that whole reclaiming that historical movement, the historical Jesus of kind of, who is this guy? Like, let's look past the miracles, look past the stuff. What makes Jesus tick? You know, let's get in there and really talk about where he's from and what his life would have been like and the anthropology and all those things. You know, let's get inside his head. And, like, what does the world look like to Jesus?
I find myself enjoying both sides of this kind of a conversation. I mean, we do the mashup at Christmas where we just throw all the Bible stories into one pot and make one story out of it, and that's the Christmas story. But then it's more fun for me to, like, look at it as different facets around the same diamond. That we've got Mark's version, or we have Matthew's version, and we've got Luke's version, and they don't connect to each other in a lot of different ways, but they're both fascinating to look at.
Right, we're asking people to loosen the reins, right? And I think comics ask people to do that too. You know, allow you to have these different facets existing around the character, and that can they all be right? Can they all be true?
So what I hear you saying is that Christian Bale Batman makes sense. Perhaps even Adam West Batman makes sense. Probably Michael Keaton Batman makes sense, but definitely not George Clooney and Val Kidd. Are you kidding?
Yes, less nipples on the yep.
That's right.
Making the same mistakes. Why do I even try? Can't put my finger on it now. And yeah.
Well, let's do our Going Pieces segment. This is our opportunity to tell people how they can get in touch with us and how we can get in touch with people. Our opportunity to plug our websites, our blogs, our Twitter feeds, whatever it is that you've got. So, Kyle, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
Well, I'm Kyle Goodman, the pastor at Concord Presbyterian Church in Statesville, North Carolina. You can find us at our website at concordpreschurch.com. Also, you can find me on Twitter. I revived my Twitter account today. In honor of having Mike on Popping Collars, and I even sent out my very first tweet. Yes, there's only one, but hey, I did it. So you can find me on Twitter at Rev Kyle Goodman. And also you can find a lot more than just one tweet on my Facebook page.
Betsy, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
Right now, I'm on summer vacation. Yay! No, I'm a school chaplain, so this is actually summer, right? So I'm a chaplain at Episcopal High School in Alexandria, Virginia. But I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Twitter at Betsy_Gons.
Mike, where are you? What are you doing? And how can people get in touch with you?
So I live in Berkeley, California. I'm a deacon in the United Methodist Church. So I figured it was about time to get the Methodists on your show.
Absolutely.
I work for the California-Nevada Conference Bridges District. So I work between the San Francisco Bay Area and Sacramento, doing a variety of different kinds of ministries. I won't go into too much of that, but one of them is the so-called Jubilee Initiative, which is a micro-lending operation, community lending operation for local churches. And then I also am supporting a village in Palestine near Bethlehem called Wadi 15 that is in danger of being exterminated by settlers. So those take up a lot of my heart. I'm on Facebook, but I really only make friends with people I know. So if you know me, I'll friend you. But if I don't, if I haven't met you, I'm afraid I will ignore you. But you can look up the Jubilee Initiative on Facebook and the Bridges District of the California Nevada Annual Conference on Facebook.
So my name is Greg Knight. I am at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida, where I work as the Director of Children and Youth Ministries. You can find us on the web at bbts.org. You can find me on the web on Twitter at that Greg Knight. Popping Collars, it tweets all the time. At Popping Collars is where you can find us. You can also friend us or like us on the Facebook because we like friends and we like likes. You can find us on the web at poppingcollarspodcast.com where you can listen to this very show. You can also listen to this show at wherever you get your podcasts, whether that be iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, SoundCloud, etc., etc. If you do find yourself on iTunes, throw us a rating and say something pleasant about the show. And also, our podcast is featured each and every time we have an episode on EpiscopalCafe.com, which is a lovely site where you can learn more about the Episcopal Church and beyond. So we love Episcopal Cafe and we recommend their site to you. And so with that, that's Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Betsy. Thank you, Kyle. And thank you, Mike, for being here. We'll see you next time.
Keep those collars popped. Woo-hoo!